This is The Meaning of Green, Season 2. I'm Vivian Thompson. In Season 1 of The Meaning of Green, my guests and I examined in 10 episodes how we have managed to solve, or not to solve, major environmental problems like acid rain and leaded gasoline. At the end of the series, we applied the policy lessons we had learned to climate change. Season 2 investigates the links between power, freedom, and the environment, and whether those links shed light on the coronavirus's emergence and spread. Today's episode is about connecting the dots between ecosystem disruption, food production, and the coronavirus. The wildfires in the western U.S. will figure in, too. This podcast is independently produced in Cedar Closet Studios in Charlottesville, Virginia. The experience I bring to these podcasts includes 20 years as a professor of environmental policy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. I've also been an environmental regulatory official at the state and national levels. My three published books are about garbage transport, climate change policy in the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, and about the dynamics of political power when we regulate air pollution. There are a couple of new resources connected with The Meaning of Green. If you want to introduce your friends to the podcast, you can send them to my new 2-minute YouTube video. The link to that video is available on the podcast's website, meaningofgreen.com. And as I did with the last episode, I'll post on the podcast's website a list of the open source resources I consulted in putting together this episode. That's for those of you who want to dig into this information more deeply. Look under Images and Information. Today, I will start with my deep distress over the wildfires that have been raging in the Pacific Coast states of California, Oregon, and Washington. I have many friends and family members in those states, and I used to live in Berkeley, Santa Barbara, and Arcata, California. When I lived in California from the late 1970s to the mid-1980s, the winter rains always came. But the state I came to love so deeply, along with part or all of the states of Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming, and New Mexico, has undergone a years-long mega-drought. California has endured several severe fire years in succession. My cousin phoned from Berkeley, California a few days ago and said that at 9:30 in the morning it was still dark because of the smoke from a fire hours away. Residents of Oregon, Washington, and California are being visited by several plagues. COVID, widespread wildfires, smoke, and the resulting wretched air quality, and low rainfall. Experts have said for decades that we would experience these and other kinds of disasters lacking effective national government policies to reduce greenhouse gases and to detect and quash virus spillovers before they spread. Fire is a natural part of the landscape in the western U.S. because so many ecosystems are either fire-dependent or fire-adapted. To take just one small example, some pine cones don't open up to spread their seeds until they're heated by fire. In the American West, people live in and near fire-prone areas. That's been true for a long time, although it's likely there are more people living near and starting fires in these fire-prone ecosystems. But the long-term mega-drought points to other underlying factors. Drier conditions mean more dead plants, increasing fire fuel. So what about forest management as one possible factor? According to today's California Fire Report, almost 70% of total burned acreage has involved nationally managed lands. No fires in state-managed forests are mentioned. Perhaps we'll need to revisit federal forest management practices and their funding. However, California's fires are happening outside forests as well, in grasslands, oak woodland, and chaparral, a type of scrub-dominated ecosystem. And of course, there's also climate change. Columbia University's Dr. Park Williams and colleagues have concluded that this drought is one of the five worst mega-droughts to have happened in the American West since the 9th century. Here is Dr. Williams on how much he and his team believe climate change has contributed to this drought. He gave this presentation at a May 2020 event sponsored by the U.S. government's National Integrated Drought System.
And so the answer to the final question is, our estimate is that yes, human-caused climate change did contribute importantly to this drought. We estimate 47% based on the multi-model mean trends in climate, but we think that there's a lot of uncertainty around that number, and we're much more comfortable saying the human-caused climate change has contributed substantially to the drought, but it could be anywhere probably from 25% to over 47%.
Ironically, state-level politicians in Washington, Oregon, and California have all supported action to reduce greenhouse gases. But California, in particular, has been at the forefront of U.S. climate change action at the state level. In 2002, State Assemblywoman Fran Pavley wrote a bill for vehicle greenhouse gas reductions. That law was followed in 2006 by a comprehensive greenhouse gas reduction program that was signed into law by Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Thus, the state that has led the nation with climate change action is now suffering some of the worst consequences of climate change. To the extent California hurts, the rest of the U.S. suffers too. It's not just that many of us have loved ones who live there. We also depend on California for our food. According to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, California produces more than one-third of the nation's vegetables and two-thirds of the nation's fruits and nuts. Threats to California agriculture mean threats to the nation's food security. And water scarcity and drought strike at the core of California's very being. Californian agriculture and California cities are possible only because of a huge system of water projects that include dams, reservoirs, pumping stations, and long canals. In much of the U.S. and in well-off countries generally, we assume we can have clean water, fresh produce, and food whenever we want it. But if it's too hot, and if there's not enough water, and if we have to keep fighting wildfires in our nation's breadbaskets, those assumptions are going to go out the window, much as normal life went out the window in March of this year. We need to face some extremely uncomfortable facts about the way we in the U.S. and elsewhere have chosen to grow and use food. Farming and food production are not what they used to be in the United States and elsewhere. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has concluded that business as usual is unsustainable. Modern food systems, a term that includes growing, transporting, processing, and eating food, are not only experiencing losses because of the consequences of climate change. They have also contributed significantly to climate change. Scientists believe that 19 to 30% of world greenhouse gas pollution comes from food systems. Food systems make up about 86% of total water consumption worldwide. This puts me in mind of what Professor Paolo Dodorico of UC Berkeley said in a Meaning of Green episode from last fall.
Water is a natural resource that is fundamental for life on Earth, and there are no substitutes for water. In recent years, I've started to study water in agriculture because it's the major form of water consumption by human societies. It is also a major factor limiting the production of food and our ability to meet demands by the growing and increasingly wasteful global population. We are not being able to create water out of nothing. With this, I'm trying to say that we still depend on water resources. They are a major factor in the production of food. Many water courses and aquifers are strongly depleted, and therefore it's important to understand the way in which in the near future humanity will be able to meet its increasing demands without increasing its footprint on the global water resources.
10% of the rainwater that falls on land is used for agriculture. Experts speak of water footprints of crops and domestic animals, that is, the amount of water consumed in producing them. The water footprint of plant food is 8 times smaller than that of animal food. Animal production worldwide consumes 75% of agricultural land area, 29 to 43% of agricultural water, 1/3 to 1/2 of total nitrogen use, and produces half to three-quarters of agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. About 8 calories of feed or fodder are needed to produce 1 calorie of animal food. Talk of food and farming brings to mind grandparents in my family who raised their own food. My husband's grandparents owned a working farm in northeast Iowa of perhaps 40 acres. They grew corn for animal feed, and they were diversified. They had dairy cattle, chickens, and pigs. They sold milk and hogs, and they grew enough food to support a family of 10. My husband's mother said they were never in dire straits during the Great Depression. In the wintertime, they would cross the frozen, snow-covered fields in sleighs pulled by horses. My husband's grandfather fixed windmills that were used to pump water for area farms. My grandmother Flora owned much less land, about an acre, in a small central Pennsylvania town. Her situation was much more insecure than that of my husband's grandparents. She was widowed in a week's time in January 1929 when my grandfather, a pianist and a music professor, died of pneumonia. My grandmother had grown up on a farm in West Virginia, but she was suddenly solely responsible for feeding and educating 6 children. Sometimes they just scraped by. My grandmother raised chickens and grew all kinds of fruits and vegetables. I mentioned her in season 1. She's the devoted Republican whose copy of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring is now on my bookshelf. Grandmother Flora was a conservative and a conservationist. She wasted nothing, and she believed in walking softly on the earth. Many modern farmers are going back to more traditional methods of farming, albeit with some modern technological twists. One such farmer is Joel Salatin, who runs the biodiverse Polyface Farms, a spread of about 550 acres here in Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley. Joel is renowned for his ecologically informed methods of growing animals like cows, pigs, rabbits, and chickens. Joel spoke at the University of Virginia at a lecture I organized some years ago. The lecture hall was absolutely packed, and the audience members were on the edges of their seats the whole time. You'll see why Joel inspires such reactions in this several-minute excerpt from a TEDx talk he gave in 2016 in my hometown of Charlottesville.
Now, the grass goes through a growth cycle, just like us, just like all living things. It goes through a growth cycle. So the 3 stages of grass I call diaper stage. So right here in this pot, I have freshly eaten diaper stage. This is infant grass. It's just been grazed and it's coming back. Here, I have teenage grass, okay? Juvenile, fast growth grass. Remember when you could eat a half a gallon of ice cream and it didn't go on your hips? This is juvenile grass. And then we come into, you know, more juvenile, but you see it starting to brown down and eventually it goes to what I call nursing home grass. Okay? Senescence, the end. So the role of the herbivore in nature is to take this as it approaches senescence, prune it back. So they prune this back to restart this rapid biomass production. Without them, it stops. The whole program stops. Now the problem is, how do we duplicate this if we don't have migratory patterns? If we don't have 4 million buffalo in a herd? If we don't have 10 million wolves chasing them, if we don't have fire, if we don't have the magnificent, amazing choreography of nature, how do we duplicate this amazing principle that hydrated, built soil, fed, you know, all the mycorrhizae and the actinomycetes and built the soils that we're still mining today? How do we duplicate that if we have a system of private land ownership and all that? Well, we do it with high-tech electric fencing. Space age microchipped electric fencing. It's almost invisible to the eye, and yet we can encircle a herd of 1,000 cows. It's practically invisible, but because it's such a strong psychological barrier, the cows learn, and it allows us to duplicate this mobbed movement that they would have had in eons before we had private land. And so we call this We call this mob stocking herbivorous solar conversion lignified carbon sequestration. The bottom line is that in Augusta County, where I live, which is over the mountain, in Augusta County, the average pasture, the biomass production, if you dry it down and you weigh it, the biomass production on the average acre of grass in Augusta County is 2,500 pounds per year. On our farm, we've been there almost 60 years. We've never planted a seed. We've never bought a bag of chemical fertilizer. And on our farm, we average well over 10,000 pounds per acre. The problem is not the herbivore. Herbivore is doing what she's always done. She's, you know, a four-wheel drive portable sauerkraut vat turning carbohydrate, fermenting it into, you know, meat and milk, nutrient-dense food. She's doing exactly what she was supposed to do. But she's not being managed the way the wild herds and the migratory patterns were managed, where they moved and they vacated areas long enough for the forage to go through this magnificent 50, 60, 70-day physiological expression cycle and then be pruned back and harvested at the appropriate time. We move the cows every day to a new spot, letting everything else rest and go through this rapid accumulation cycle. And what it means is that we triple, quadruple, and even quintuple the amount of forage that can be produced on a certain area. Now, that cow is dropping 50 pounds of goodies out her back end every day. Suddenly, you have soil building capacity. So here we are not only harvesting way more, but we're sequestering way more carbon. We're using the animal in its historic role. We're honoring and respecting the cowness of the cow. And we were branded Luddites and anti-progressives, anti-science, you know. Go on, get with the program, Salatin, you know. What's this grass stuff? 40 years later, there's this sudden global, oops, maybe we shouldn't ought have done that.
Some of you might know the Dr. Seuss book, The Lorax. The Lorax, a mythical creature, says, I speak for the trees. We might say that Joel speaks for the cows. For Joel, respecting nature's rules equals productivity and the power to keep providing food, even in times of crisis. Joel is not only a farmer, he's a prolific author, having written 12 books. So what is it that we shouldn't oughta done? I've divided these shouldn't haves into four categories. First, kill animals and process meat in huge industrial meat processing facilities. Such plants in the U.S. have been responsible for huge outbreaks of COVID-19 among workers. Second, rely on underpaid, underprotected immigrants to pick our monoculture crops. Even before the fires broke out, California's agricultural counties were suffering high COVID-19 infection rates. In Monterey County, just to take one example, 75% of COVID cases are among Latinos. The infection rate among agricultural workers in Monterey County is 3 times that of non-agricultural workers. In the U.S., there are no nationally set COVID protections for farm workers, leaving that task to the states. California has just adopted a law intended to increase those protections. As smoke has spread widely, the state government has also distributed N95 masks to farm workers. In the U.S., if those workers aren't out in the fields, they can't feed their families. They don't have safety nets. And the fruits and vegetables will just rot. The third thing we shouldn't oughta have done, intensify. Intensification means that more crops are planted in a given area and more animals are crowded together in small quarters. Although this might sound like a good idea in theory, more product from a given area, right? The methods for increasing yield too often involve more chemicals, more pollution, more energy inputs, and more water than less intensive methods. To take one conspicuous example, nitrogen fertilizers have been instrumental in the Green Revolution. But a large percentage of nitrogen applied to crops, or that's eaten by animals in the form of food, is transferred to the environment. After being released, nitrogen contributes to many adverse impacts, including algae blooms in waterways, groundwater contamination, acid rain, and greenhouse gas pollution. Concentrated animal feeding operations are sources of a long list of harms, including, but not limited to, overuse of antibiotics, which leads to microbial resistance, transmission of infectious disease, toxic dust and gases that have caused illness in workers, respiratory illness in surrounding communities, excessive nutrients from waste discharged to nearby waterways, which can cause a host of problems, including dead zones. The fourth thing we shouldn't ought to have done is consolidate on a huge scale. The vast majority of farms worldwide are smaller than 5 acres, or about 2 hectares. But those farms cultivate only a small portion of total farmland. The largest 1% of farms account for 70% of all farmland worldwide. Since the mid-20th century, we see this pattern of farm consolidation in most high-income countries, like the U.S. and many EU nations. That is, there has been an increased concentration of farmland among larger farms. This trend also holds for Brazil, a country I love dearly. In most lower and middle income countries, average farm size has decreased since the mid-20th century. At the same time, the number of small farms has increased in both the US and Brazil. Perhaps this points to more farm-to-table enterprises. A big hole in all of these data is China. Consolidation and intensification mean factory farms. A study published in 2014 concluded that 6% of farms in the U.S. produced 3/4 of all U.S. farm output. In 1987, the median U.S. hog farm sold 1,200 hogs, as compared with 30,000 in 2007. Here, Professor Delia Grace Randolph of Greenwich University in the UK addresses the issue of diseases in concentrated animal feeding operations. Professor Randolph is a leading expert on the intersections of animal, human, and environmental health.
Most new human diseases come from animals, and especially from wildlife. However, domestic animals play an important role, not only as sources, but also as amplifiers and bridges between wildlife and people. In fact, we may think of these novel diseases as coming from a deadly intersection between 3 sectors: human health, animal health, and the environment. Well, domestic animals are important, if nothing else, because we humans are so numerous and we have altered our environment to such an extent, and that has included keeping animals for food, companionship, and other tasks. And many of these animals are kept in what's called intensive systems, because in order to have many more animals than people to produce the food which people demand, the systems which allow this to be done most easily are what we call intensive systems, which often involve keeping large numbers of animals closely confined. Now, this is good for high production, but it's also good for growing diseases and for allowing diseases to spread. And also, in many of these systems, animals have been bred for decades for production and for being able to live closely together, and they're often genetically very similar. So this kind of closely packed, huge communities of genetic clones make ideal medium for rapid spread and mutation of diseases. And in recent decades, we've seen many of these production systems start to shift to developing countries, low and middle income countries, which is where most of the demand for animal source food is now increasing. Unfortunately, many of these countries have not been able to fully manage the biosecurity, that is all of the health, the hygiene, the separation required to keep intensively farmed animals healthy, and especially to keep them out of contact with wildlife. And again, many of these animals are being sold and marketed in ways which are not conducive to health or hygiene. The workers in these systems, be they in meat packing plants or abattoirs, are often stressed, low paid, and have little access to healthcare. All of these coming together mean that domestic agriculture, intensive agriculture, is part of the problem of pandemics. and one of the solutions as well. And we will talk more about that when it comes to One Health.
This clip was from a July 2020 United Nations Environment Programme webinar dedicated to the report called Preventing the Next Pandemic. We'll come back to that report and related studies on pandemic prevention in future episodes. The number of domesticated animals on Earth is truly staggering. Professor Ron Milo of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel and his colleagues published an ambitious study in 2018. They estimated the biomass of each category of living organisms on Earth and the historical impact of humans on global biomass. They concluded that plants make up about 80% of biomass on Earth, next come bacteria at 13%. Animals as a whole, on land and sea, are only 0.4% of the Earth's total biomass. Professor Milo summarizes the study's main findings here in a YouTube video posted by Ambiente y Medio.
So the trend that we saw in terms of the change in biomass throughout time shows that there is a significant decrease not only of the biodiversity, which has been studied a lot, but also in terms of the biomass. So we show that we, humanity, decreased the overall biomass on Earth about twofold. The amount of mammalian biomass, mammals, since humanity arrived, has decreased about sixfold. And we could also see that the changes that we make on Earth right now are very significant. For example, we saw that domesticated mammals that we grow are about 20-fold more abundant than all the wild mammals that exist on Earth. So if you think about the puzzle that I'm doing with my daughter of, say, a puma next to an elephant, next to a giraffe, it should actually be a cow next to a cow next to a cow next to a pig, given the scientific evidence of what exists on Earth right now. So I think the first thing is to appreciate the changes that we, humanity, are causing on Earth and that they're very widespread. And then actions to try and conserve some habitats, for example, big nature reserves, are a big step forward. Many of the changes are also dependent on what we choose to eat and how it's being produced. There's a lot to be said about taking into account the environmental burdens of our food and comparing between the different options. This is a way in order to ensure that we'll still have abundant wildlife while still having a high quality of life.
And so we circle back to the need to preserve biodiversity. You'll remember Professor Kate Jones, the ardent defender of bats and the professor who, among others, has linked virus spillover with ecosystem disruption. Professor Jones and her team compiled a huge database of emerging infectious diseases. Their database has served many researchers in different capacities. One recent analysis of those data showed that agricultural drivers are responsible for nearly 50% of zoonotic diseases that have emerged since 1940. By presenting an extended excerpt from one of Joel Salatin's talks, I've already hinted that we have a good sense for how to mend our broken food systems. We in high-income countries have the obligation to lead the way and to help other countries as well. But we can't just expect farmers with Joel's outlook to take over. We must institute appropriate policies and adopt appropriate habits, including avoiding food waste. I'll take up this subject next time in an episode called Paths to Fixing Broken Food Systems. That episode will appear in late September. I'm Vivian Thompson. Thank you for listening to The Meaning of Green.